In this episode, we're going to be talking about the possibility of rape and the accusation of sexual assault. Please be aware, and if this isn't the kind of thing that can work for you this episode, go ahead and skip it and join us next time. The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution. So they cried out to the Lord in their distress, and God saved them from their desperate circumstances. God brought them out from the darkness and deep gloom. God shattered their chains. Let them thank the Lord for God's faithful love and God's wondrous works for all people. Because God has shattered bronze doors and split iron bars in two. This is the word in black and red. Hello, and welcome to The Word in Black and Red, where we read the Bible from a leftist and liberationist perspective to elucidate the way people of faith and their comrades can understand the Bible as a source of healing, love, and liberation for all people. I am your host, Michael Belong, the wise old Lama MB, joined today by the wonderful Pastor Don of Unfinished Community, and of course, our wonderful semi-permanent co-host, L. This is going to be a wonderful conversation. We have, in the pre-conversation, we've already gotten to so many things that I literally had to cut off the conversation so that we could start recording and make sure that we got it all to you. So I'm going to go ahead and dive into Genesis 39, 1 through 23. When Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, Potiphar, Pharaoh's chief officer, the commander of the royal guard, and an Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man and served in his Egyptian master's household. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made everything he did successful. Potiphar thought highly of Joseph, and Joseph became his assistant. He appointed Joseph head of his household, and put everything he had under Joseph's supervision. From the time he appointed Joseph head of his household, and of everything he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's household because of Joseph. The Lord blessed everything he had, both in the household and in the field. So he handed over everything he had to Joseph and didn't pay attention to anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. Sometime later, his master's wife became attracted to Joseph and said, "Sleep with me." He refused and said to his master's wife, "With me here, my master doesn't pay attention to anything in his household. He's put everything he has under my supervision. No one is greater than I am in this household, and he hasn't denied me anything except you, since you are his wife. How could I do this terrible thing and sin against God?" Every single day she tried to convince him, but he wouldn't agree to sleep with her or even to be with her. One day when Joseph arrived in the house to do his work, none of the household's men were there. She grabbed his garment, saying, "Lie down with me." But he left his garment in her hands and ran outside. When she realized that he had left his garment in her hands and run outside, she summoned the men of her house and said to them, "Look, my husband brought us a Hebrew to ridicule us. He came to me to lie down with me, but I screamed. When he heard me raise my voice and scream, he left his garment with me and ran outside." She kept his garment with her until Joseph's master came home. And she told him the same thing. "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us to ridicule me came to me, but when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment with me and ran outside." When Joseph's master heard the thing that his wife told him, "This is what your servant did to me," he was incensed. Joseph's master took him and threw him in jail, the place where the king's prisoners were held. While he was in jail, the Lord was with Joseph and remained loyal to him. He caused the jail's commander to think highly of Joseph. The jail's commander put all of the prisoners in the jail under Joseph's supervision, and he was the one who determined everything that happened there. The jail's commander paid no attention to anything under Joseph's supervision, because the Lord was with him and made everything he did successful. As we look at this text, this is a story that we know has been written from a particular perspective, right? And so we're going to look at this one perspective with a number of different perspectives to sort of wrap around the episode, to wrap around the story and say, what if this was actually the case? What if this was what was happening here? And try to read behind the story, like we do with so many stories, like everyone does with so many stories, to understand what might be deeper there we can learn from. So first off, we're going to take the idea that this is exactly the story. This is exactly how it happened, that here we have Potiphar's wife, who is just this immoral woman who does this terrible thing to Joseph. Don is already raising his hand. So,
all right. Well, one of my favorite observations in this text is probably best introduced in this particular interpretation. And look, you all know my love of Robert Alter as a biblical translator. And, you know, there's been a lot of good biblical translators over the years. But in reading this passage, the thought that keeps coming back to me is all biblical translators are cowards. The reason I say that is because the expressions that Potiphar's wife is using in here are always watered down out of the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Now, in the back half of the passage, she's much more fluid and flexible in her phraseology, and we'll get to that later on as to what that might actually mean. But here at the beginning, when she's talking to Joseph, the phrase she's using that's translated as, lie with me, in the Hebrew is skibaimi, which an appropriate translation for the directness and forcefulness of what she's saying is, fuck me. Like, mm-hmm. She is extremely blunt and direct with what she's reported as saying here. And so I will repeat, biblical translators, listen up. Y'all are cowards.
Like, literally, the most literal translation of this is, do the sex to me. Or
yeah, like, pretty much.
Right? like do the sex to me, put it in there. Like, you know, they're in a language that is incredibly euphemistic, like Hebrew. This is not very euphemistic. And here instead, we see a very watered down version of this in the text.
It struck me as more of like workplace sexual harassment. Like, any sort of person who's experienced that, like, they'd probably like feel the vibe from this passage of like a boss or a manager coming to you and being like, well, it, you know, if you want to keep your job, tit for tat.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it. I don't want to be gross or anything.
I will say it is worth noting in verse 14 here, and I'm going to draw back to Alter here again, her wordplay, particularly with the guards. The way she uses the word us is noted here, suggests that they all could have been game for this lascivious or mocking barbarian from the north. It's an obvious attempt on her part to enlist their sense of Egyptian solidarity. She's probably suggesting the very supremacy of this foreigner in the household is an insult to them all. So as she pivots to the guards, she immediately starts phrasing it in ways that the guards would read as dog whistling. It kind of like, you know, switching your language about the darker skinned folks when you start talking to the cops. Like, it's kind of the same sort of deal. Doesn't make, like, again, hearing that come from a white guy, not supporting that. That is a bad thing to do. But that is kind of what she's doing. She's code switching for negative effect here, at least as far as the language as presented.
Well, and this also strikes me as in really stark contrast, like the way that this story is repeated over and over again stands in stark contrast to Genesis 24, right? Where it's an outsider who is going to go and find for Isaac a Hebrew wife, right? And so he goes back to his master's household and goes and finds Rebecca, right? And Rebecca is this woman who shows up. There's deep yonic imagery here, right? There's deep sexual imagery here in the text. And the story gets told three times over, right? Where it's, this is what happened that proved to me that this was supposed to be. And it goes over and the details change just a little bit each time, depending on who the audience is, right? But the story is repeated these three times. Whereas with the servant of Abraham, who's in the tradition identified as Eleazar is telling the story to show, oh, look, this is what Rebecca is supposed to be like. Here in the opposite direction, oh, this is what that dirty Hebrew Joseph is like, right? And so it's an inverting of that same sort of story.
One thing that I do like to do too, and this is, I guess, in favor of the straight reading, double entendre, very much intended, is thinking about these stories in their narratively intended context. And I'm going to unpack what that means a little bit. You've got to go back to how these scriptures were originally, before they were written down, before they were put to text in the first place. These were oral histories that were shared around the campfire for a narrative form of moral instruction. And what we get in this story is a extremely patriarchal society. And that's what the ancient Hebrews were. They were an extremely patriarchal society in which women were seen as property without a sense of agency. And what we have here is a female character that is introduced who not only has sexual agency, but has sexual dominion. And so in the context of a bluntly, flatly, exclusively patriarchal society swapping stories over the campfire, the existence of this character, her morality notwithstanding, as a woman who can exercise sexual domination over a male, I mean, it can be interpreted two ways. You can be interpreting it as basically an ancient Hebrew horror story, which I think doesn't do them enough justice. Although, you know, in fairness to patriarchal societies, maybe. But I would say more likely that this is part of that larger biblical narrative, if we take this interpretation, of introducing a polar opposite to the current restrictive system in the means of breaking you out of binary thought processes. And we see this again and again with the Bible, where you're told X group is the outsiders, and then a book or a chapter or even a verse later sometimes, you're introduced to one of the outsiders being welcomed into the group. Like this sort of, here is our template, let's break it methodology is very common, particularly in the oral histories as introduced. So this may have a certain narrative utility in its original intent to break the kind of early misogynist ideas of that heavily patriarchal society. Is it elegant? Is it the best way to do that? I'm sure we can sit back with thousands of years in hindsight and say, okay, well, that's not how you introduce strong female characters. She needs to be dressed all in leather, have tightly cropped red hair, and needs to be thrown off a cliff at the end of four movies. That's how this works. But no, like this is, I think, within the context of this interpretation, at least, I think this is a solid attempt to do that within that narrative, larger kind of social context.
I don't necessarily disagree at all, but I also think that like, this is also a rich woman, and rich women always have a different sort of sexual agency than any other woman. And we just did Tamar, and I guess I would kind of argue that Tamar had a little bit of sexual agency in getting her reproductive justice happening, but this is like this kind of sexual agency, like in the context of what wealthy people do with it, which is abuse it and like exert it on people who don't want it.
I think it does still have some of that agency in the fact that it is, of course, a woman who is abusing power and not men who did it all the fucking time. Amen, amen. That's just life within that society. So there's some of that utility there, but you are absolutely right to smack me down with that one, and I very much appreciate it.
And it may just be that, like, it's because she's Egyptian, so, like, that sort of, like, in the context of, like, the Hebrew patriarchal society versus an Egyptian patriarchal society, like, the woman being a powerful abuser is just, like, that much more shocking in this context, so.
And at this point, a lot of that's guesswork, too. We don't really know, like, everything about the context of that. And like, I've talked to people who are reading, like, the old, you know, some of the Syriac translations and some of the real ancient scrolls. Even they don't really know this shit too well. So some of that's just guesswork. I'm going to introduce this point as well. And this is as much personal interpretive as it is, like, based on my own research or anything like that. But when I go out the Bible, particularly in my own podcast video series, one of the things we keep coming back to constantly is that God's theme often seems to be the immorality of the violation of consent. And what we're seeing here with here, and this is an important distinction here that, as you rightly point out, conservative churches and like never make, is that the immorality of her actions, if you're taking the immoral woman interpretation, the immorality of her actions are not rooted in the sexuality of her actions. They're rooted in the consent violation of her actions. And that is an important distinction that should be made and rarely ever is that she's not wrong to be horny. She's wrong to take it without consent. And that's like that's why it's the passage is, I think, laid out like this, again, under this interpretive framework, is to highlight that. And, you know, to highlight that, okay, the sex part isn't necessarily the bad thing. It's the fact that she was trying to get it where she ain't supposed to get it. Like, one would imagine that were she to deliver that same, you know, skibayimi to her husband, it'd probably be fine. Probably would have gotten a different result. And that's probably why it's not in the Bible.
To bring this to modern conversation, right? Like, this is the unicorn hunter, right? Like, this is the same reason that people don't like unicorn hunters as a bisexual person, right? Is that you've become fetishized just for what you can do rather than like who you are as a person, right? It is literally just objectification. And it's objectification in the opposite way of what we in our modern society and honestly throughout most of history have experienced, where like this is a woman who is objectified, right? And in turn, she objectifies Joseph, right? And the text here really leans into this. When in verse 6 at the end, when it says, "Now Joseph was well-built and handsome," the term there is yepheteor, and that's a term that we're going to turn back to in a later interpretation, but it is a term that is literally only used for women elsewhere in the Bible, for his mom specifically in Genesis 29, and then for Esther in Esther 2:7. And so it is a feminized term that is only ever used for a male biblical character here in this verse.
So this is going to show my like lack of knowledge. I didn't go to Bible school. Are there any other like explicit slaves in the Bible, like on this par of slavery?
Elle, I think one of the reasons that you're such a valuable member of this team is that you didn't go to Bible school. and I say that seriously because, and we consistently have guests on who are not experts in the Bible, right? Not everyone here is a biblical scholar. I love nerding out with Don about the Hebrew of a lot of this text, right? But that isn't the point, right? Liberation theology is a theology that's done with all of us. You don't have to be an expert to belong here, right? We're all coming here to the text, and I wouldn't have thought of this as a worker's rights abuse because that isn't something that I carry with me all the time when I'm reading the Bible, right? I think about that in my own life, but I don't think about it actualized here in this text. So I just want to say that you don't have to be a Bible scholar to be on this podcast. I've never held that. I don't want anyone to think that. And Elle is a wonderful contributor and our most common contributor because she brings a perspective that is always valuable.
But going back to your point of like, he's referred as this like feminized objectified term, like I think that is specifically because he is a slave in this situation. Mm. And this passage also reminded me of the Starz series Spartacus, where all of the gladiators owned by this guy at the Ludus, which is gladiator school, basically, like they're all enslaved. Mm. And they all have to fuck his wife. Like, it's not a choice matter. Mm. It's not a like, well, she's hot, so yeah. But like most of them don't want to do it because, you know, they're enslaved and are training to kill other people. And eventually it leads to, you know, a wonderful slave uprising.
In the New Testament, there is the book of Philemon, is a book from Paul to a slave master, basically saying, hey, your slave Philemon is really important to me. I want you to free him so that he can come along with me on my missionary journeys. Now, there's debate to be had on whether or not that is a, hey, Christians shouldn't have slaves, which he makes that argument pretty explicitly in the book, but I think he makes it pretty explicitly in the book. But there is all this sort of subtlety and the nuances of niceties and Roman culture and all that sort of stuff surrounding a, hey, you're a Christian, so you got to stop treating this guy as a slave. But even in the book of Philemon, Philemon is not a main character. The main character is the master who Paul is talking about. So no, I can't think of any other example of a slave really being the main character in this story. Anything else about Potiphar's wife being an immoral woman?
I mean, just that Potiphar's wife's immorality is all about the violation of consent because she's fully objectified Joseph. Yep. Like, it's not about her wanting to fuck him. It's about her putting hands on him and then using racism to like throw him in jail when he refuses her, which is gross.
It's definitely not something that happened in American history over and over and over and over again, right? Okay, we're going to turn from that, the sort of quote-unquote straight reading of the text. We're going to switch from this is what the text is trying to tell us, and we're going to say instead, okay, that might be what the text is trying to tell us. What actually happened? Right? Because this text is very sympathetic to Joseph, right? This is told by the descendants of Joseph. They're obviously going to try and paint him in a better light than he is. Now, I say that with a grain of salt. We can see throughout the text that the patriarchs we're not necessarily good people, but but Joseph, you know, is not depicted as a particularly bad person, I think, until later on in his story, when it's made very clear that he is no longer a good person through the corruption of the power. But here in this story, let's complicate it a little bit. Let's talk about this story as a story of Joseph as a straight dude who goes and tries to rape Potiphar's wife.
I will say this interpretation of Joseph as the kind of de facto bad guy here, there's not as much textual support for it as there are for other interpretations. I'm not going to say it's wrong. I'm not nearly so bold as to do that. But I will say it is less supported. That being said, some of the points you make, like Joseph seeing her as furniture, for example, actually just kind of makes sense in terms of the fact that that's how the culture of the time saw women. Now, there may be an intercultural piece to this in the fact that Joseph's Hebrew culture saw women as property and maybe the Egyptians didn't quite so much, or the power dynamic could play into that as well to make it more appropriate. But as a general surface read, as far as the context of the Bible and the context of Joseph, yeah, women were treated as property within the bounds of that society, so it wouldn't have seemed so much an out-of-place comment. So while I am going to be firm in the position that there is less textual support for this interpretation, as far as the larger framework of the Bible goes, I will also say it doesn't fucking matter, because the end result of it gets us to where we're going anyway. So you can be a scriptural or translational literalist you prefer and say, well, it's just not supported by the text, which, well, like, let me tell you about how Jesus was trans and shit like that and how important that is. Anyway, but in the same vein, you can be a little looser with your interpretation and say, this is the way I choose to understand it. And that is, for lack of a more appropriate term, safe to do here interpretively, because it doesn't change the narrative structure, doesn't change the overall takeaway from the Joseph story and arc all that much. And it gives you something that you may need to lean on if the story of an aggressive male is something that's necessary for you in your particular walk of life through the Bible at this particular point in time. It's different than, say, interpretations of render unto Caesar that mean pay your taxes, everybody. That one cannot be interpreted that way. And is a terrible idea. Don't do that. That's not what it means. And it changes the narrative. It's fine. Like, yes, the story can be understood in this localized context as being wildly different depending on which way you look at it. But in the overall scope of things, it doesn't actually change God's story, God's redemptive arc. So utility would be the determiner there.
For me to really engage with the idea that it's Joseph coming to rape Potiphar's wife, I kind of have to really lean into, like, the other pieces of the text that, like, despite being in bonds, Joseph is really, like, looking to bootlick his way to power. You know, you don't get placed second in command if you're, like, doing a bad job or not, like, doing as told. And it's just very hard for me to even, like, try to see it from, like, Joseph being the aggressor in this situation, because the power dynamics just lean so strongly in the other direction for me. And also, like, I'm from a cultural context where chattel slavery existed, and the same sort of, like, woman in power using her privilege to, like, sentence people to death or to jail, like, happened all of the time. So with all the things in the text, it's a little too hard for me to, like, see him as an aggressor rather than an objectified person who suffers under their, like, situation. So, yeah.
So let me make the strongest case possible for this, right? The strongest case possible is that we basically throw out most of what the story says, and we only focus on what the story doesn't say. And so what does the story not say? The story doesn't name Potiphar's wife, right? We keep talking about her as just the wife of Potiphar, right? Why is this story important? Because in the story's logic, something is happening to Potiphar, not to Potiphar's wife, right? This is a violation of the property boundaries of Potiphar, not his wife. And so she does not get named in this story because she is not really the important part here, right? It goes back to our story on Dina, right? Where Dina, as the violated sister of Jacob and Reuben, she is not really the thing that's as important as the fact that their honor is what is violated, right? And so here in this story, we see that same sort of thing happening. Potiphar's wife does not really matter all that much. We also see Joseph saying, I have been given everything, but not you, right? Well, how do we turn that on its head? I've been given everything, but not you, and I want that as well, right? And so throughout the rest of the story, for this interpretation, we basically have to throw out what the Bible actually says and say instead, what is actually going on here behind the text? Now, we are working on the assumption, based on our cultural assumption, that it would go Egyptian man, Egyptian woman, slave, right? But I don't think we have as much evidence for that order of things, right? There were stewards who would be have been considered above women, right, in various different ancient cultures. So what is the power dynamic there? Is the power dynamic of Potiphar actually having a closer relationship with Joseph than he does with his wife, right? And we'll get into this in the fourth interpretation, where what if the wife doesn't really have that strong of a relationship with Potiphar, and so is looking to redeem it in some way, and Joseph takes advantage of that. And so then we read the rest of the story, and we assume that this is true, right? Well, what's the evidence that it's true? He left his garment there, right? And, you know, it's a convenient story that a lot of the time when there are people who want to claim that the victims of their sexual abuse are not really there, they'll say, oh, she has no evidence. She has no evidence. Well, what are the systemic things working against her having evidence, right? Or working against them having evidence? Rape kits are often not tested, right? Their circumstances are not believed. They don't have witnesses, or the witnesses that they have are other people their age. And so prosecutors say that they're lying, right? There's all of these things set up in our culture, which is supposedly a more civilized culture, you know, 3,500 years later from this story. Supposedly, we are advanced beyond this and don't think of women in the same way. And yet we have the same sorts of problems where women are not believed when they have the physical evidence to prove it. Potiphar's wife has the physical evidence to prove it. And instead of listening to the woman, the biblical authors are saying, no, our guy was innocent. She had the garment because she stole it from him, instead of the more obvious answer that he attempted this, he left his garment with her, and she had it afterwards.
I don't know, Micah. It sounds like you're trying to discredit a male victim of assault, which is another major problem in our society.
Yes.
And like, yeah, I'm by no means a biblical literalist. And yes, like Egyptian women were not like crazy powerful, but there were Egyptian female pharaohs and queens of high regard. And if you look at things like that, a rich Egyptian woman, like the lady who picked up Moses and like took him in, they've got agency. They've got enough. And I can't get on board with that interpretation because it feels like too much of reaching for me.
So first off, I am 100% with Elle on this one. I'm not on board with the interpretation of Joseph of the aggressor for much of the same reason as someone who's been a victim of sexual assault on a male. Like, yeah, it's one of the few examples we have in the Bible of that happening. And if we go back to the concept of narrative utility, which I'm talking about, if you want to go to the Bible for examples of women getting shit on by men, you have your pick of the litter here. You really do. A lot of cases where women are treated all kinds of foul by the men around them. Not a lot of cases where the opposite is true. And since the Bible tends to deal a lot in its major stories with narrative utility in that way, I would suggest that this, I won't say firmly disproves the interpretation, but definitely renders it into a significantly less likely category. The other piece I wanted to speak to as well, the issue of the garment. And here I'm going to do my thing and read directly from Alter's notes on this one. Garment, beged, is a generic term. It is certainly not an outside garment or coat, as E.A. Spicer has it, although the Revised English Bible's loincloth probably goes too far in the opposite direction. In any case, Joseph would be nearly naked when he runs off, leaving the garment behind in her grasping hand. So she didn't grab his loincloth or his undergarments. He wasn't wearing a thong that she just kind of ripped off with her teeth or nothing like that. But it also wasn't a coat either. So this was probably more like she ripped the t-shirt clean off of him or something. He probably wasn't wearing a whole hell of a lot as a slave in the household. So there are interpretive directions that are gone with this in biblical translations that would seem to suggest Josephus E. Greth, like, ha-ha, she ran off with his loincloth. Why'd she get his loincloth if he wasn't doing the thing? It probably wasn't his loincloth. That's translationally inaccurate. So this is one of those that is often used in defense of the Joseph was the aggressor theory that doesn't hold up linguistically quite so well.
Yeah, and I want to be clear that I am in no way trying to diminish the experience of people who experience sexual assault on either side of the gender spectrum, right? As someone who is raised classically male and is also the victim of sexual assault, I don't mean to take that away from anyone. And I simply offer this other interpretation because I think that the Bible has an agenda, right?
No.
And the Bible's
agenda
is often...
No.
Yeah. What? What? And that part of our liberatory readings can be resisting that agenda in various ways, right? And so I think you can read that Joseph is the abuser in this story, right? The way that Potiphar's wife is not a character, right? In so many ways, that her identity is not that important, that she is left as an object, and that, you know, in this story, she is believed, but in so many stories of people who are actually the victims of sexual assault, that then the perpetrators of that sexual assault turn it around to make themselves look like the victim. I'm thinking of the famous case, I can't even remember their names because I hate them so much, but the swimmer, right, who made it sound like the girls that he raped came onto him, right? Or the guy who went around roofying all of those people and then made it seem like they were coming onto him. And, you know, and that's why he had 47,000 affairs, right, on his wife. And these are names that I'm specifically not naming, even though I can remember some of them, because they don't deserve to be remembered. And so that, I think, is one of the counter arguments to this interpretation, right? Is that I am purposefully forgetting the names of those rapists. Perhaps that is what's happening in this story as well, right? Maybe Potiphar's wife is not remembered precisely for that reason. I'm making a case for a possible interpretation that I don't necessarily hold. I don't think that you have to hold this interpretation. I don't think you have to reject it either. But I think it is an interesting perspective to look beyond the text, to read the text with suspicion, and to say what could actually be going on here, especially in a book that is so often just taken at its face value, right? So the third interpretation that I want to offer here, and this is sort of a mixed bag, right, is there are two ways that you can take this one. And that is my favorite interpretation, that Joseph is just queer, right? And so, like, there's all of these other things that are going on here. And this is explored in a paper that I really enjoy, Searching for Redemptive Readings by Marjorie Lehman at the Jewish Theological Seminary. She's looking at Leviticus 18:22 and 20:13 in the Midrashic tradition and looking at the Mishnahs and the different interpretations here throughout history and trying to understand where they're coming from. And she points out the fact that throughout this conversation that Joseph is very queer-coded, right? That it's possible that Potiphar is interested in Joseph sexually. There's, you know, possibly they have a different relationship going on. But she is the one who points out that Joseph is feminized in this way after having worn the princess dress, right? That he is described as Yafeh Teor, the beautiful one or beautiful woman, where everywhere else it is translated as beautiful woman. And this is the only time this ever happens to a male biblical character, right? And so he is made queer in this way, in a way that shifts the story in important ways.
This is an interpretation I like, but it's one that in order for it to work, we have to be very biblically adept in how we look to things. And I'll point out that, like, the Yafeh Teor, which we can kind of roughly translate as kind of like goodly in person or beautiful of face or something like that, is not, I think, and this is like, I'll admit I have a reasonable knowledge of biblical Hebrew, but I am by no means an Old Testament scholar. And I will defer to Old Testament scholars who will no doubt be in the comments screaming about how wrong I am. But a cursory look, at least, at the Hebrew presented here, Yafeh Teor are both masculine singular constructs here. So they're not necessarily feminine grammatically. So if we're going to derive femininity from their application, it would be in their use. And this is where I am unfortunately going to have to directly contradict something you said. This is not the only case, Joseph, where these terms are used on a male figure in the Bible. And so the idea of it being unique to Joseph is, I'm sorry to say, just not accurate. However, now that I've said that, the biggest case of it also being used on a male figure in the Bible is our good buddy David, who is also extremely queer-coded.
I'm going to go ahead and just read Lehman's writing here. And on page 63 and 64 of Searching for Redemptive Readings, Joseph is destabilizing. He mixes up male slash female categories. For example, Joseph dresses in the coat his father gives him, a ketanet pasim in Genesis 37:3, that is worn only by women in biblical sources, for example, in 2 Samuel 13:18. He is the only biblical male character referred to as Yefei Teor, a term used only to describe women, including his mother Rachel in Genesis 29:18, in Deuteronomy 21:11, and Esther 2:7. And he is ostracized for exhibiting otherness by his male brothers, eventuating their decision to force him into a pit in an act that feminizes, dominates, and debases him, like men do to women they want to control. Joseph's sister Dinah is also sexually compromised, and like Dinah, rather than being like the other men in his family, Joseph is powerless, unable to defend himself against the ire of his brothers. Additionally, in being the son of his mother Rachel, and therefore beloved more than his older brothers by Jacob, he unsettles the rules of male primogeniture, eventually becoming a leader over them. Finally, the question of why Joseph resists Potiphar's wife looms. And so that is a really succinct case of these six different ways, right, that Joseph is queer-coded in this story. He mixes up the male and female by wearing a princess dress and being a beautiful person in a language that doesn't often describe them as these things. If we are saying that this is a true accusation, right, one of the ways that might be happening here is that Joseph might be a queer person who's trying to present as straight, right? He is able to dominate so many other things in this thing. He's able to be successful here in Potiphar's household. And maybe he's trying to work his way up and be like, no, I'm straight. I'm definitely straight, right? Look at this. I can be more powerful than this woman. But I think that the queer interpretation much better offers an interpretation that says, this is why he's running away from this scenario, right? Not just that he wants to avoid sinning in this scenario against God and his master, but that he isn't really interested in sex with a woman in the first place, or, you know, all those sort of things.
I think it's worth mentioning as well, what you mentioned about Joseph potentially trying to pass as effectively straight in this context here. I think that is something that should be highlighted a little bit more here, too, because, I mean, we can assume, if we're taking the queer-coded interpretation to heart, we can assume that even if it wasn't explicitly solely that, that there was probably a good edge of solid homophobia in the way his brothers treated him. Like, that was probably a big part of it. So in his new Egyptian setting, this is, and this is psychologically important here to understand, we have a Joseph who is dealing with some very particularized trauma, who has recognized the reasons behind why he was treated. And while there's nothing he can do about favoritism, he can't handle how to do that. And if favoritism comes up again, like, he's more likely to grab at it because that was his safety net before it was ripped away from him. But if his sexuality was a component to his abuse, yeah, that would probably be psychologically the thing he fixates onto and tries to say, okay, this time I'm going to be the favorite again because I'm awesome, but we're going to hide this piece because that's what got me into trouble the last time, and ain't nobody going to see that again. Ever again. I am going to go so far into the closet that people are going to think it's Narnia. I'm going to strap some thrusters on that bitch and turn it into a TARDIS. That is my way of doing things. and that makes sense. Like, that is a totally legitimate response to this kind of trauma that he's probably gone through here. And this is a thing that happens in our world all the damn time. And being able to take a minute and recognize that is, even when we're talking about Joseph as queer-coded, it's a step we often skip over. The necessity of hiding, and even to a certain extent, the weaponization of the closet, in a sense, of what Joseph's doing here. Now, is that a healthy choice? Fuck no. God, no. But of the choices afforded to him, it is certainly a logical one. And given the trauma he's likely responding to, it's certainly an understandable one. And I think one that we could afford to spend more time in our churches and in our interpretive communities is spending a minute trying to understand.
One thing to consider is that, like, archaeologists and Egyptologists from the 18th century onward were Victorians and had a lot of Puritan sentiments. Also, a lot of things got destroyed over time. But from all the records and laws that have ever been, like, found, there's nothing saying that, like, it was criminalized. Everything written about sexuality in ancient Egypt was, like, fully coded in euphemisms. But there have been several like art pieces that are like, you know, the Victorian interpretation would be, look at these gal pal roommates just hanging out in the same pose a married couple would be in. And there's been several tombs of men buried together in what seems to be like a marriage situation. Although they did have like a wife and kids outside of that. But like when they were buried, they were put with his, you know, his best man. Like some people have tried to like excuse that, saying that they were conjoined twins, which like conjoined twins surviving to like full adulthood and then death in ancient Egypt. That's a pretty wild.
They were conjoined, but not in the way you think.
Yeah, they weren't conjoined there. But I mean, if Joseph was queer, there's nothing saying like in ancient Egypt, he wouldn't have been able to like participate in that. But being a slave, would he have a choice on who wanted to like use his body as an object?
And this comes back to the point I made earlier, too, where in the period, both in Egypt and in the Hebrew cultures, the dimensions of sexuality were different. Your marriage relationship, your sexual relationship, your emotional relationship were not necessarily seen as all being the same thing in the way we tend to see them today. And the social relationship had an aspect to it as well. And I'm by no means an expert on ancient Middle Eastern sexuality. Hell, I'm barely an expert on my own sexuality, and that exists right now, and I can access it every day. But that being said, like, you're right, absolutely right, El, to identify the fact that as a slave, that would have changed the dynamic. But it's hard to say whether that would have made him more likely to be accepted or less. And I would, in fact, tend to codify towards less because slaves were commodified in that context, which would mean their utility within the social construct, as far as their sexuality went, would be more along the lines of a real doll. So... yeah, agency wasn't really a figure there. So whether his homosexuality, heterosexuality, his preference, to paraphrase Cell from the Dragon Ball Z Abridged series, his compliance wasn't a factor. So in how he was applied within the context of that society, he was a tool to be used. So his sexuality didn't really enter into the picture that way.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting, too, that doesn't take away from the potential queer-codedness of the situation, too, because... if we imagine Joseph as a completely heterosexual man in that environment, and, you know, your hot boss's wife is rolling up to you saying, let's fuck, like, the ability to say, well, Potiphar didn't give me the ability to do that, and the management of his household, like, I'm sorry, your blood's long gone off of the top here, and you are not going to be able to figure out how to be that eloquent in that situation. But if you're, like, the farther away from explicitly heterosexual you get, the easier it is to parse things in the terms that Joseph does here. Like, from an act of simple cognitive biology here. So, like, both of these things can be true simultaneously. She could have rolled up on him and said, hey, you're a slave, therefore you're a sex toy, hop on this bitch. And he might have said, well, I may be, but because of my queerness, I have the superpower to say, no, boss said no, and maybe I'm going to kick the can on this one down the road a little bit.
You know, and I hear someone in the comments saying, and Joseph had two babies. Well, you know, maybe he found the one woman that he was attracted to, right? You know, or maybe, you know, maybe he was at a particular point. Maybe he was at a particular point in his bicycle where he wasn't attracted to women. So, you know, he didn't want to get with Potiphar's wife. There's all sorts of reasons why he could have not wanted to sleep with Potiphar's wife, including what the story explicitly tells us.
Neither us nor the Bible will stand for bi erasure.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, or it could just be very simply that what the text tells us is that he didn't think it was okay. He thought it was a sin, so he wasn't going to do it.
I won't be doing this like all the time, but like, not to defend straight men, but I am.
Oh, don't. We suck.
Like, just because it's a woman coming on to a straight male doesn't mean he wants to sleep with her, just period. Like, that's it. You know, like, there's plenty of reasons for a straight guy to not want to fuck any woman he sees. And it plays into like that, like, men can't be controlled. So you ladies, you have to gird yourself, purity culture, to like interpret it in that way.
You're absolutely right.
That's the last time I'm defending a straight man.
All of these interpretations, I think, are really good things. I read this interpretation in the African Multidisciplinary Journal of Research, which is just one of the most underutilized resources, I think, in the West. I highly recommend that everyone go and just start reading more literature that's coming out of Africa and more analysis of literature that's coming out. But there's this paper, Revisiting the Character of Potiphar's Wife, A Narrative Criticism of Genesis 39 by I'm going to get these names wrong, and so I apologize ahead of time to these wonderful people, Chipchumba Becky and Chosefu Chimorian. And they just do a brilliant analysis of this story. So everything that I'm about to say is directly stolen from them, not my own observation. So if you think this is brilliant, please go and tag them and say, hey, you're awesome. So first off, right at the beginning of the story, we see in verse 6 that Potiphar is not really interested in anything but eating, right? He is this sort of classic glutton, right? Where he handed over everything he had to Joseph and didn't pay attention to anything except the food he ate, right? Well, who is missing in that picture? He's not paying attention to his wife, right? And so there is a really good interpretation here that in this ancient Egyptian system, typically what happens in the household is that you hand over control of the household to your wife, right? And the woman is the head of the household. She takes care of everything. And the man is, you know, going off and working and whatnot. Well, because Potiphar is the Pharaoh's chief officer, he doesn't have a real job. He's a CEO. He doesn't actually do anything useful for the nation. So he is just this useless guy who goes off and all he has to do is worry about his food, right? Which means that he's first off, totally upended the power balances in his house and doesn't seem to be paying attention to it. And that Potiphar's wife is now left without any power beneath this other person, right? And I think this plays really well into what we were commenting on earlier, the fact that racism is used here to dismiss him, right? That people who are out of power then turn to racism to try and say, hey, this person is the disruptor. Let's go get rid of them so we can have our power back, right? But in their interpretation, it doesn't really matter whether or not Potiphar's wife was actually trying to sleep with Joseph. Instead, what she's doing is that she's a brave woman who will do anything she can, including playing this trickster card to get Joseph out of there. Joseph is a threat to her power. Joseph is a threat to her affection with her husband. Joseph is a threat to potentially the perpetuation of her line, right? The continuation of children. If her husband doesn't pay attention to her, she might not have a kid that can take care of her later, right? All these sorts of things are going on here. And so she's actually brave and she's honest. Potiphar knows that his wife is not going to lie about anything, so she's going to tell the truth. And so she makes this accusation. She, you know, tries to get Joseph to come along and lay down with her, and just as an excuse to get his garment, so she has the evidence to go to her husband and say, hey, look at what he tried to do to me, and get rid of her rival to her husband's affection and the running of the household to get her power back in this scenario.
If you keep in the queer-codedness of that, that kind of makes me see Potiphar's wife as a TERF. Like, TERFs are generally, like, very white woman exclusive feminism. So they're benefiting from the white supremacy aspect. Mm-hmm. And they, like, by focusing on, like, exclusion, they're trying to maintain this, like, bit of power that they've been tossed by white supremacy, that, like, they're the correct type of female. And, like, they've built up their entire identity around this bit of power. So when someone non-conforming to that or someone who's more marginalized than them is in their space, they get even more like defensive and angry and like, no, you can't be. There's only one way. They're reactionary to like that identity that they've built for themselves around this like teeny bit of power that the power system has like doled out to them. But that's like that's my interpretation of TERFs.
I think to make the scenario a little bit less of a, like, this is a good enemy to have, right? I'd like to compare her not to a TERF. I'd like to compare her to a union worker who sees immigrant labor coming in and sees the way that that can, if they don't build solidarity, can threaten their position in society, right? Where you bring in somebody cheaper and they can scab against you and all those sorts of things. But instead of building solidarity with that person, tries to push them out, right? That's the wrong tactic, right? But a TERF is someone who is objectionable because their whole point is, right, that they want to keep on to the limited power that they have so they condemn everyone around them, versus someone who is using the wrong way to try and get back to what they do deserve, right? Potiphar's wife does deserve, I think, to have this power in her life, right? She does deserve to have the respect of her husband. She does deserve to have the attention of her husband. She does deserve to be in a loving relationship. And there are some commentators who say that, well, actually, she wasn't able to have a child because her husband was not paying attention to her, right? And so, like, she wants a kid. She is not getting a kid. She deserves to have a kid. All of these sorts of things that I think can make her a more palatable character than just a TERF, right? In this interpretation, I think that we can say that Potiphar's wife is fulfilling the same role of trickster that we've seen so many biblical heroes fulfill, right? And we can say that it's wrong, but not that it is the most evil thing in the world. Like Jacob stealing his brother's birthright, right? That's clearly wrong. It causes a rift. It causes a break in the relationship. But it is not nearly as severe as trying to rape someone, right? Like, there's a difference there in severity. And so I think this interpretation allows me to say Potiphar is still a sympathetic person who uses the sort of imagery of this thing happening to be able to regain her power in her home that she needs to have for her survival, right? Just like Tamar committed a trickster act to get what she needed to have power in her society, to have her line be able to continue, I think that Potiphar's wife can be viewed in the same way as doing what she needs to make sure that her family is protected as well.
I see. I know. You may not believe me, but I've tried my best to be sympathetic to Potiphar's wife. But I see her more as a foil trickster to Tamar rather than like she's like Tamar. No, Tamar was achieving justice. She sees the means of reproduction. Potiphar's wife, like, to her, maybe it seems like justice is restored to her household, but she's just perpetuating more of these power imbalances where Tamar corrected power imbalances.
Elle, I really like that foil to Tamar. I think that is right. That even though, like, the difference is that Tamar is seeing the way that justice has to be done for her family. Her tricksterness is not causing someone else to suffer, right? She's just getting justice. She's just getting a justice that brings about wholeness to the whole family. And her trickster action ends up being the way that Judah's line continues, right? Judah's line does not continue through his other son. It continues through Tamar. Mm-hmm. And in that way, she not only saves her family, she saves Judah's family. She saves all of the Jewish people. And she ultimately brings about the salvation of the world because Jesus is born from that line, right? And versus Potiphar's wife, where it is, I want what I should have had back, right? This is a reactionary sort of justice. This is not a, we're seeking justice so that we can all live. This is a, I'm seeking justice for myself because I can get this thing back if I cause an injustice to someone else. So I love that. I love that pushback. And that's why we have Elle on the podcast, right? Is not because she's not because she's a biblical scholar, although she brings amazing scholarly concepts to the text. But even on an episode like this, where I just at the last minute said, hey, Elle, I'd really appreciate your perspective on this episode. She's able to jump in and just bring an interpretation that is beautiful and wonderful. And you, dear listener, if you think, no, I can't do that, give it a try, right? Type out the things that you're thinking about the episodes in the episode discussion in the chat and talk to me about it. And let's get you on an episode, because I think that people talking about these things, engaging in this text in really deep and meaningful ways, brings new light to the text that I am certainly not able of reaching on my own. So thank you. Thank you all for being here.
You too can make Don frantically look shit up.
Yeah. Thank y'all so much for being a part of this wonderful podcast. I just so appreciate it. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to these very different interpretations of the text that I think all offer particular insights into these characters and what we're supposed to get from this text, right? Where we are struggling to balance both stories and balance listening to the victims of sexual assault and understanding where they are. And how do we seek justice in these situations? How do we seek justice in complicated situations of oppression? And I think it really requires listening, right? And requires listening to each other. And instead of becoming adversaries with each other, standing in solidarity with each other and saying, instead of what is Potiphar's wife versus Joseph, saying, how could these two achieve what they needed to achieve? Joseph, a liberation from slavery, Potiphar's wife, importance to her husband, by coming together rather than being driven apart. Well, thank you all so much, Pastor Don and Elle, for being a part of this conversation once again. Dear listeners, you can go and follow Pastor Don at Unfinished Community and Elle at the hopefully soon to be dropped Saints and Sinners podcast, which I am looking forward to listening to as well, especially her takedown of Dorothy Day.
I'm not taking her down. I will be taking down Billy Graham.
Yeah.
Yeah. Billy Graham takedown.
So, fuck that guy.
Pass Micah, take it away.
Thank you, Future Micah. And of course, you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. Now, dear listener, go. And instead of looking for the ways in which we might fight against one another, let us strive for solidarity, so that we do not accomplish a justice for some that is an injustice for others, but a justice that leads to liberation and peace for all. Shalom. And from my understanding, Gen Z actually has a really interesting take on this interpretation because they add skibbity toilet, right? Giyas. Sorry, I don't know what any of that means, but it does sound vaguely like the Hebrews. I apologize for this terrible joke that did not land.
That's going to be the bong hit.